This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Georgia Senior Senator Saxby Chambliss is retiring at the end of this year. He decided not to run for re-election in the most recent campaign. Senator Chambliss joins us now in his office in Atlanta. Senator, thanks so much for being with us, and all the best in your retirement.
Well, thanks, Dennis. We're Julia and I are very excited about life after the Senate, something we always wanted. And as you know, when I came to Congress in 1995, never thought I'd be here 20 years, and that's one of the reasons I'm leaving. But we're truly excited about life after the Senate. It's been a great run. Very humble and honored to represent 10 million of the greatest people in the world, but also very excited about the next chapter in my life.
A few months, though, before you announced you were not running for re-election, you told me you were definitely going to run. So what changed your mind?
Well, at that point in time, I really hadn't given the thought that I always give before making a decision on whether or not to run for re-election. And what one of the key issues that made up my mind was actually being formulated just as you and I were visiting then. And that is, you know, I'm a big family man, you know that. And at that point in time, my grandson was, he was then a 10th grader when I was making my decision. He'd been a 9th grader the year before, and during the spring of that year, John had had 16 baseball games, and I saw none of them. And that's not me. I don't miss my children's activities or my grandchildren's activities. And it, between that and the frustration that I had experienced over the last 3 or 4 years or so, that's pretty well what made up my mind.
Tell me a little more about that frustration. Was it just lack of ability to get things done? Was it a feeling that even in your own party, there were folks who were ready to challenge you and that you thought, well, maybe this is more than I want to take on?
I was never threatened or intimidated by a potential challenge. You always expect that. But when you're getting ready to run again or contemplating running again, you always do the necessary polling. You always get out on the ground to get the feel of people. Our numbers were as strong as they ever have been. We were extremely confident that if anybody did decide to challenge us, whether it was in a primary or general, we'd win. Elections in Georgia are never easy. They're awfully expensive. I knew that if I did run, I was going to have to raise $15 million, which even in today's world is very challenging. And I, in thinking about the possibilities of opponents, it just never was a factor in my decision.
Yeah, you said there was frustration. Was it just because of what's often called the gridlock between Capitol Hill and the White House? And is there enough blame to go around here?
There's plenty of blame to go around to everybody. I was very frustrated as we went through the Gang of Six process, for example.
This was on deficit reduction.
Exactly. We're, you know, last week we surpassed $18 trillion in debt that we now owe. And Senator Warner and I assembled a group that tried to deal with the issue. We came up with some positive solutions.
And Senator Warner's a Democrat.
And Senator Warner's a Democrat. There were three Democrats, three Republicans in that group. We come from different philosophical standpoints as well as different parts of the country. And we made the hard and tough decisions within the group that would have solved the problem long term. And when we made our presentation to Senate leadership, it fell on deaf ears. And that was Senate leadership on both sides. Nobody at that time, as we were heading into an election, wanted to put their members in a position of having to take hard and tough votes. But, you know, that's why we go to the Senate. That's why people send us there. When this country gets in trouble, they depend on their elected representatives to do the right thing. And we knew this was the right thing. And yet, we were all frustrated, not just by leadership, but by folks on both sides of the aisle who didn't want to deal with Social Security even though it was going broke, who didn't want to deal with Medicare even though it was going broke, who didn't understand that neither just reducing spending or raising taxes was going to solve the problem. And what we decided was that you have to have a combination of three things: reduce spending, reforming entitlements, and raising revenues through reforming the tax code, not through raising taxes, would benefit the American people in a huge way, and it would set our economy on a pathway that the world was starving to see.
It is now 3 years later. The long-term deficit or debt is bigger than it was, and yet our annual federal deficit in 2014 was actually $197 billion less than it was in the previous fiscal year. Is that a sign that we're moving in the right direction?
Well, our economy's improving. I mean, you just look back at where we started, and the baseline right now is basically 2009. And certainly we're doing better than we were in the time period following the recession of 2009-10. But when you look at the long-term picture, we know now that if something doesn't change, that by the year 2030, and that's really not that far away in today's time frame, that if we don't change the way Washington operates, that members of Congress will have interest payments and entitlement payments that have to be made that consume 100% of the tax revenues coming into Washington. And everything we fund, whether it's defense, housing, whatever the program may be, it's going to have to be on borrowed money. And that's not the way to run a government. That's not what people expect when they send us to Washington. So what I do take great comfort in knowing is that the Gang of Six laid a foundation, and part of that foundation has already been built on. Sequestration's a poor way to do business, but it has reduced spending. One of our recommendations was the elimination.
That's across the board cuts sequestration.
That's right, yeah. Sequestration is 10% of spending across the board reduction. The CLASS Act, which was a part of Obamacare, has been repealed. That was one of our recommendations. So certain things already have been done, but they've been done in a piecemeal way, and at the end of the day, you're not going to solve the problem until you put the whole package together.
But if you and other members of the group that helped put this together leave out of frustration, what are the chances that anything will get done?
Yeah, out of the six original members, only three are going to be left. We expanded the group to include Senator Johans and Senator Bennett. Senator Bennett will still be there. So four out of the eight will be there, and I hope they can corral enough of our colleagues who are still there to get on board with re-energizing this issue at some point in time. And I think they will. I mean, even the president has been talking recently about major tax reform. The House is talking about tax reform. Leadership in the Senate is talking about tax reform. It's unbelievable what major tax reform will do to the economy of the United States. And that's a key portion of ultimately solving this debt problem.
Part of tax reform, you've said in the past, is lowering our corporate tax rate. But and whether or not that stimulates the economy, does it also exacerbate the problem which we now have, which is our poverty rate still very high, and the gap between the wealthiest Americans and the poorest Americans, excuse me, continuing to grow?
The reason it does not increase that gap and will actually close that gap is this. Today, American businesses are making decisions based upon where they can get the best return of their investment. And where they invest their money is where jobs are being created. When you look at the tax rate that American corporations have to pay today, and our rate's in the 35% range, and you look at any other country in the world, any other industrialized country, their rate is not just lower, it's significantly lower. So the return on the investment that corporations make, and be mindful of the fact that they have to answer to shareholders, and we know how sensitive that issue is today, American corporations are making decisions to invest their money overseas because they get that better return, and therefore they're increasing or making the economy of those countries where they invest better. They want to invest in the United States. It's pretty clear. But they're not willing to look their shareholders in the eye and say, gee, we'd rather pay a 35% tax rate than a 7% tax rate. They're going to get run out on a rail if they do that over the long haul. So that's why there are lots of corporations who are investing in other countries that would rather be investing in the United States.
But won't lowering the corporate tax rate, given the deficit problems we've already talked about, shift the tax burden to other people? Somebody's going to have to pick that up unless we want the deficit to get bigger.
Well, what the goal of every economic plan I've seen has been is to increase taxpayers, and that's what you do by increasing jobs. When you lower the corporate tax rate, you're going to have to lower the personal rate to be competitive with the corporate rate. Otherwise, you're going to have everybody going to a C corporation versus an S corporation. And today there are many more S corporations, particularly in the small business world. And as long as that corporate rate between individuals and corporations is equal, then you will see S corporations thrive. And as long as that is the case, you'll have a lower personal rate and a lower corporate rate. That's why you'll close the gap in the those that have and those that don't.
You mentioned working in the Senate on deficit and debt reduction. The Senate also passed an immigration bill. It stalled in the House. A lot of other Senate measures have stalled in the House. Was part of your frustration the fact that House Republicans simply couldn't even get on the same page themselves a lot of the time, and a lot of the measures that the Senate sent over died in the House?
Not really, because the House is an institution in and of itself. I served over there 8 great years. I thoroughly enjoyed the House. For the last 12 years, I've just been totally focused on what's going on in the Senate. Now, naturally, we confer with House members on a regular basis. Speaker Boehner is one of my closest personal friends. I have dinner with him a couple of nights a week. So we talk about policy to a certain extent, and I will visit with him on major issues that I'm working on. But I never would try to give a sales pitch to the House on what they ought to do. Any senator would be crazy to do that. And the House has to operate within its own atmosphere.
But is it difficult for Speaker Boehner to get stuff through when his own caucus is as divided as it is?
No question. I mean, that's been very clear. And immigration is the one issue that everybody points to, but there have been lots of others, even issues that we're going through right now as we close out the year, and we're trying to get a defense bill, a tax extender package, and a, what we call an omnibus package or a continuing resolution, whichever it turns out to be. He's having a difficult time. I used to tell everybody that the President of the United States had the toughest job in Washington and thereby in the world. Not anymore. Speaker Boehner has the toughest job of anybody.
When you came into the Senate, it was certainly a partisan atmosphere. You came in amid criticism of one of your campaign ads that showed Osama bin Laden, I think Saddam Hussein, in a blast at Max Cleland, the incumbent senator at the time. Was it difficult to repair those bridges at the time and make those connections across the aisle?
No, I had 2 members of the Senate who had something to say about my campaign, which very honestly, when I raised that issue back home, people's eyes glaze over. They said, what are you talking about? Because people at home understood that campaign ad had a lot more to do with Max Cleland putting his arm around George Bush in his campaign ads than it did anything else. And Bush clearly was on my team. But I went to those 2 individuals straight up and had a conversation with them, both of them, when I explained to them where we'd come from and what had happened in the campaign. I said, look, we didn't understand that. We apologize. You'll never hear from me again. And neither one of those senators have ever said one more word about that. They've been good friends.
Did you ever talk to Senator Cleland about it?
Max and I have had any number of conversations over the years. I think he was very distraught about losing. That's not unusual. And we haven't had any intimate discussions about the campaign. He's a friend, and I respect him. I have the utmost respect for him. But no, we haven't gone into depth on the campaign.